Building Bridges with Mimi Rosenberg and Ken Nash.
Now, standing with the Cuban people equals demanding that the U.S. government lift the economic blockade. We're joined now by Gail Walker, Executive Director of the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization, IFCO, Pastors for Peace, working on projects to bring about reconciliation and normalize relations between the U.S. and Cuba and challenge the U.S. economic blockade of Cuba, and Rosemary Mealy, American journalist, writer, and activist who has lived and worked in Cuba, author of Fidel and Malcolm X, Memories of a Meeting.
Gail Walker, Rosemary Mealy, thank you for joining us to talk about the way to stand with the Cuban people is for the U.S. to stop weaponizing food and medicine as international sanctions and to lift the 60-year blockade against the Cuban people. Rosemary, Gail, begin by talking about your interest and involvement with Cuba.
My work as the director of IFCO, the Interreligious Foundation for Community Organization, our special project, Pastors for Peace, through which we have organized countless caravans and delegations to Cuba to help people really see and understand the reality. We've been doing this work since 1992. My first trip to Cuba was with the Vince Ramos Brigade, and that was courtesy of my dear friend Rosemary Mealy, who came knocking on the door and saying, you need to fill out this application, get to Cuba, explore and see that reality. So my work has been involved with Cuba for nearly 30 years. We've seen the ups and downs of what Cuba has had to face and endure as a result of U.S. policy since the triumph of its revolution in 1959. But my work with IFCO and the organization goes back those 30 years. It's really that work, that motivation that is the impetus for us continuing to stand in solidarity with Cuba, especially at this time when its people are really enduring such hardship as a result of this longstanding 60-plus-year-old draconian blockade against its people.
So Vincent Amos Brigade, which I had the pleasure of being on as well, was a friendship solidarity effort to have people in a work capacity get to know the grassroots realities of Cuba. I want to ask you just a little bit more politically about the evolution, but the development of your political interest working with IFCO, trying to provide material aid in response to the blockade of foods and medicines and goods for the Cuban people. Why support Cuba when we're being told that Cuba is a repressive structure of governance that oppresses its people?
The work that IFCO has been engaged in as it relates to reaching out to different countries that have been relentlessly beaten up on by U.S. imperialism goes back beyond the 1992 when we began organizing caravans to Cuba. For years, IFCO, under the direction of my father, the late Reverend Lucius Walker, was engaged in domestic community organizing, but also connecting the issues and concerns at the grassroots here in the U.S. with the international community. We did work in Southern Africa. We did work in Central America, Nicaragua, El Salvador, Honduras, Chiapas. But it was in 1988 that we really began our Pastors for Peace project because we had taken a delegation to Nicaragua that had been attacked by Reagan's Contras, who he was calling freedom fighters. And we knew were viciously attacking the Nicaraguan people. We saw that firsthand as the passenger ferry we were traveling on was attacked, first with individual gunfire, then machine gun fire, and then heavy artillery, all in an attempt to intimidate the Nicaraguan civilians from supporting their socialist government at the time, the Sandinistas. That was, for me, certainly an eye-opening experience, and I think really helped to, you know, politicize me in a way that no other experience could have, being shot at watching people die and many people being wounded, one being my father, and it was after that that he formulated this project, Pastors for Peace. During that trip, I got a chance to even meet, for the first time, Cuban doctors, to learn a little bit about Cuban reality, to be able to speak to these doctors who had been there trying to help out in Nicaragua, Cubans, learn from some Cuban educators and learn more about Cuba's commitment to providing health care and educational resources, that was the priority. At that time, I was a college student and grappling with college debt. That wasn't something that, you know, that Cubans had to see and experience. Nicaragua, being shot at by the Contras, understanding the complete hypocrisy of a U.S. support of the Contra forces, meeting Cuban on the ground, Cubans, doctors, educators, and really beginning to understand what it meant to support a people where the need was needed most. All of that kind of came to a head for me on that passenger ferry on the Rio Escondido back in August of 1988. And here we are nearly 30 years later. The motivation that I've been able to build on based on my own experiences, but also based on the experiences of elders who were helpful in leading the path and leading the way and helping me to sort of see things in a different way, is all what brings us here today when we look at what's going on with Cuba.
So Rosemary Neely, what brought you to a lifetime now of political work around the issue of Cuba? Of course, a wonderful book, the kind of dialogue between Malcolm X and Fidel Castro, which melded so many of your Afrocentric sensitivities with the issue of the revolutionary state of Cuba. But tell me, what brings you to that lifelong issue of support for the Cuban people?
My trajectory dates back to when my father was listening to the radio in 1959. We grew up in the southern part of the United States, and he was a farmer, but active in the NAACP during that period, which was dangerous for a black man to be involved. I do remember when he heard over the radio that Fidel Castro and the July 26th movement had seized power in Cuba from the Batista regime. My father saying, they better watch out for that boy. I'll never forget that. And referencing to Fidel. Now, at that time, hearing that, I really didn't understand the magnitude of what he meant in the dialect of a southern farmer. But later on, in going to school and hearing about the anti-communism that's rising about Cuba, my interest in the country obviously began to gel with my involvement in the Black Liberation Movement. Certainly being in the reparations movement during the latter early 70s, and then later on, a lot of my political activism emerged within being a member of the Black Panther Party. Hearing about Cuba was a natural, a norm within my political reality. But it wasn't until 1972 when I first arrived, like Gail and like you, at the Jose Marti Airport on a late night from Mexico City, where I was traveling with more than 150 members of fifth contingent of the Vince Ramos Brigade. So that legendary Cuba Solidarity Organization has certainly been an impetus for many of us in our own involvement. Also, getting involved and knowing about the Institute, the Cuban Institute for Friendship with the People, which is like the host organization for any North Americans or international groups traveling to Cuba. My long circuitous route to Cuba was in part, it was an open defiance of the United States laws that said that as U.S. citizens, we could not travel to Cuba without a license issued by the U.S. Treasury Department. So like many, you and yourself, I wanted to see firsthand what this Cuban Revolution was all about. So for 5 weeks, you know, we did this volunteer work. We traveled around the country. We had a chance to experience what it was like to know and learn from Cubans who came from every walk of life, what life was like now as a result of the revolution. That was like my introduction. I then became a member of the National Committee of the Vince Ramos Brigade, where I subsequently had quite a lot of opportunities to travel back and forth to Cuba certainly experiencing the wrath of Cuban exiles in this country, being almost dying one day from their attempts to assassinate some of us who were involved in Vincent Ramos Brigade activities. But my commitment to this work, especially letting black folk in this country know the significance of that revolution and what it meant, it was like a journey for me to become more involved in bringing the Cuba experience and the knowledge about Cuba into the black community. That became a real commitment that I've had over the years. The other thing that happened to me was in the early 80s, I was asked by the Cuban government to come to Cuba as an internationalist. That was such an honor, where I actually worked for Radio Havana Cuba. That was a whole other experience, because the project that we were working on had a lot to do with what the U.S. government was doing in terms of broadcasting Radio Marti into the country. And so having an opportunity to live and work in Cuba was really an honor for me. And the work, subsequently just began to evolve over the years once I returned back to this country, always linking the role of Cuba internationally to all the work that I do, the community work that I do. And I graduated from law school, bringing the whole issue of the draconian nature of the blockade, of the illegality of the blockade, the Helms-Burton Act, is the result of this hostility that says that U.S. people cannot travel to Cuba, there can be no trade to Cuba, that the extraterritorial arms that stretches to international...
Well, hold on to that for a moment, because we're going to get back to that. President Joe Biden called protests in Cuba remarkable and a clarion call for freedom, praising thousands of Cubans who took to the streets to protest food shortages and high prices and the corona, amidst the coronavirus. So what do you say to people who, both in terms of the political ideology and then in terms of the substantive hypocrisy, which certainly disclosure, the three of us think, is part of the U.S. rhetoric as it maintains a blockade against vital foodstuffs and medicines and the like against Cuba. So how do you respond to this? This was a clarion call for freedom.
My first fight back of all of this is to lay out the history. It's been 60 years that the United States government has attempted to overthrow the Cuban Revolution. That's fundamental to explaining. Why? Because Cuba chose a new path to development. It chose a socialist route to development. And the word socialism scares people. We're talking about a more equitable society, a society where health care is free, education is free, where people's needs are met before profit. And that's the difference. The United States government cannot stand the fact that 90 miles from its shore, there's another kind of way in which people view the world. There's a different kind of economic and social structure that exists that is counter to the capitalist orientation or the capitalist way in which we have to live, struggle, survive, eke out a living in this country. And that is the reason why we're hearing all these issues about there's no freedom. The United States cannot stand the fact that a government exists outside of the United States that does not align itself with the values of capitalism. That is the fundamental issue that we're faced with here. And because of that, it's necessary to destabilize that government, to bring it down, and to do it in the most inhumane ways, and that is to starve the people, to make the people get to the point where it's impossible to survive, you know, where you have to stand in line and see what has happened. The United States globally has placed in that context a whole structure that there can be no interaction between Cuba and any other nation. So let's blockade them. That's why we call it a blockade instead of sanctions. So that's how I remember.
And, yes, scale,
and I would just dovetailing on what Rosemary has said. Historically, there has been this attack on Cuba for 60-plus years from the very beginning, and it's been relentless. But, I mean, if we go back to the very beginning of the triumph of Cuba's revolution in 1959, we had a memo that was put out by the then Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs, Mallory, and the Assistant Secretary of State, following him, Rubottom, who indicated, I mean, in very clear terms, their intent. They referred to the need to really do what they could, do all that they could to undermine Cuba. This was a memo that was put out in April 6, 1960, which prescribed measures to bring hunger and hardship to the Cuban people. It's very clear. That was in the very beginning and has been consistently pursued, this policy, until today. USAID that's currently offering grants of up to $1 million to groups who will, quote, bring democracy to Cuba. The current Secretary of State, Blinken, under Biden, who has continued Trump's policy of accusing Cuba of human trafficking, claiming that Cuban doctors are subjected to, quote, forced labor, equating them as slaves, height of insult when we really look at what slavery is all about, a special immigration parole that was developed to entice these doctors to defect in an obvious attempt to counter the goodwill that Cuba has gained by its medical internationalism with the numerous doctors, 3,700 healthcare workers and 52 international medical brigades to 39 countries. That's over this past year alone that Cuba has dispatched to help defeat the pandemic. Cuba's international medical brigades that have treated patients and saved lives in the past 15 years or so in 50-some-odd countries confronting natural disasters and epidemics such as COVID-19 and Ebola in West Africa. The U.S. has continued to try to discredit Cuba's international cooperation in the field of health, even though it's recognized internationally. Medical program has been recognized by dozens of countries, the UN, the World Health Organization, and other organizations. So I just think that it's important to note the way in which this undermining has been part and parcel of U.S. policy from the very beginning of its revolution. And that's what Cuba's up against, but that's what Cuba's friends are up against as we push back against this misinformation campaign, regardless of whether it's the New York Times or it's, you know, the progressive, quote-unquote progressive MSNBC. These are the words, the messaging, the disinformation campaign that is so prevalent that Cuba has had to combat. And I'll just say Biden came out and spoke about his supporting the Cuban people. Well, we all know that if he really was about supporting the Cuban people, he would end the blockade. I mean, that's the way you do it.
Is part of what you're both suggesting that what is also going on is we're seeing these protests in the U.S. media, that they are actually being, in many ways, orchestrated by Cuban dissidents inside and outside of Cuba, and maybe even openly funded by the U.S. State Department. Is that what we're also something that we should understand? Because they are showing pictures of what appear to be thousands of people, and they are suggesting that there are people throughout Cuba that are calling for, yes, foodstuffs, et cetera, but are certainly saying that they are calling for, in quote, freedom. So how do we understand and look at that as well? And then, of course, we'll continue to talk more about the economy and the blockade.
Number one, there's a law that has codified the United States being able to do things, and that's why I think it's important that, what is that law? There's something, the Helms-Burton Act. And the only way that the blockade could be lifted totally, it would have to be done through legislation. But meanwhile, the president has the authority to do exactly what we saw happening under the last administration and how Biden is continuing that. So I think that that's an important piece. But getting back to your question, no doubt about it, it's documented. The covert ways in which the United States government is using our taxpaying money by the millions of dollars to funnel money into Cuba to those there are groups in Cuba who want to bring capitalism back to Cuba. There are groups there who do that. True. I mean, even the government acknowledges that what the blockade has done, it has further, especially during this period of COVID, the social ills and conditions that people are experiencing. The fact that they have found a homegrown solution to COVID. I mean, they have 3 COVID vaccinations, right? But you need resources on the world market to be able to expand access for that. So that's not happening. The government acknowledges that, yes, there are issues occurring in the country that's impacting people. There are food issues. There are issues of transportation. There are issues of health needs. However, the tightening of the economic, commercial, and the financial blockade that Washington has maintained for the past 60 years adds to these economic strifes that are occurring inside of the country. No one is saying that these things are not happening. So what do you do? We've seen how the United States government has used economic coercion to funnel monies into countries around the world to destabilize those economies. We saw it in Jamaica. We saw what happened during the Manley era. We see it in what's happening in Venezuela. So what's happening in Cuba? This country is using this period to further the possibility of trying to push people to the point where they could say, look, we need a change. But then you have these groupings there who are actually receiving financial assistance in order to be able to do what we see occurring on the television. And it wasn't spontaneous. Those were coordinated demonstrations. And there's documentation. We can give you a list of the millions of dollars that are being funneled into Cuba right now to undermine the revolution.
Gail? And that's historically been the case. USAID is currently offering up to $1 million to groups, grants, to help, quote unquote, bring democracy to Cuba. Yeah, I just want to say, you know, Cuba's been battling COVID-19, as has the world, for well over a year. But the difference is that it's doing so with the boot of the U.S. government, you know, on its neck, doing so in the context of an aggressive campaign of U.S. hostility and the tightening, as Rosemary mentioned, the economic, commercial, financial blockade that Washington has maintained for more than 60 years. Daily life is difficult in Cuba. There's no doubt. I was there 3-4 weeks ago, and it was heartbreaking seeing the long line, seeing all of what the Cuban people have had to grapple with, talking to doctors who said, I spoke to a surgeon friend who said, we can't perform surgery because I don't have antibiotics or pain relievers to prescribe to my patients. We brought suitcases filled with medicines. It was a drop in the bucket. And of course, it's not meant to be that biblical pastors or anybody else bringing suitcases full of supplies is meant to address all of Cuba's needs. The only thing that can address Cuba's needs is having the space for it to act as a sovereign nation, and that's having the blockade lifted once and for all. But the reality is that while the media has painted a picture of severe unrest in Cuba, yes, there's difficulties, and there's none of us, none of Cuba's friends, none on the island are trying to deny the difficulties and the hardships. But at the same time, I think it's important to acknowledge that there's also support for Cuba, for the Cuban people, for its revolution, for its government. And those are images that we're not seeing in U.S. media. But that's happening in Guantanamo and Cienfuegos and Las Tunas and many other provinces as well. There's a reality that we've got to also, you know, really, with a realistic lens, focus in and a critical eye on what's really going on the ground.
I want you to both lift up what has become, certainly it's 60 years that it's gone on with Cuba, but it's become more prevalent in the international community against Iraq, against Venezuela, as Rosemary mentioned
Syria.
A moment ago, and that is the use of as a terror tactic, weaponizing people's need for medicines and food. And most goodness gracious, in the context of a worldwide pandemic, talk about the politics of the imperative to similarly understand that blockades have to be lifted, because weaponizing against civilian populations, weaponizing food, people's hunger, people's need for fundamental human rights and staples of life, is what I would consider to be a war crime.
Yes, I mean,
absolutely.
It's a crime against humanity. I mean, we can pull that out from an international perspective. What they're doing is perpetuating genocide against 11 million people. We have NGOs that are being given, for example, the State Department has something called the National Endowment for Democracy, through aid. They have these groups to help for democratizing Cuba through aid again. I mean, we're talking about millions of dollars that are being sent to Cuba to, quote-unquote, democratize the country. This is taking away from taxpaying citizens like us right here in this country. Billions of dollars that are being used to undermine, and this money is being used to weaponize and undermine a sovereign nation's right to exist. And I think that that's an important point, and that's why when we hear people like Biden and everybody, all the pundits now, even the bipartisan position, not to mention the role of the Miami and the New Jersey Cuban American politicians who are actually calling, quote unquote, military invasion of Cuba at this point. It's just amazing. Those of us in the United States are up against this. We are up against politicians who are buying into the propaganda. So that's a challenge. But meanwhile, another spark that has caused the Biden administration not to shift away from the Trump administration's policies is the embarrassment that's in at the United Nations. Every year, nations demand that the United States lift this embargo. And this year, it was almost unanimous, with the United States and Israel voting against it. But the popularity, I mean, the Cuban Medical Brigade has been nominated for a Nobel Peace Prize. This is all in the face of the fact that the United States government is isolated, in a sense, but yet they're using the tool, the economic tool, to attempt to undermine Cuba's right to exist.
Rosemary Mealy, author of Fidel and Malcolm X, Memories of a Meeting. Thank you for joining us. And Gail Walker, Executive Director of IFGO Pastors for Peace. This has been Building Bridges with Ken Nash and Mimi Rosenberg.